Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Melanie, and I am reading the Big Bend Sentinel on November 19th. Martha's Contact Tracing Program Shown to Reduce Local Spread by Stephen Paulson. Martha. Despite being in existence for just around 2 months, Martha's three-person team of contact tracers has already caught more than 20 coronavirus cases and has likely stopped around the same number of potential new infections from occurring. That was the big takeaway from a presentation at a virtual city meeting last week, where Don Culbertson, the head of Martha's contact tracing team, gave updated statistics on the city-run program. In total, Culbertson said, on Thursday, the Martha contact tracing team had investigated 24 people who tested positive for coronavirus. From those contacts, the team found 63 other people who had likely been exposed to a confirmed positive case. The team then followed up with those people within hours, asking them about their symptoms and getting them coronavirus tests if warranted, according to Culbertson. And of that second group, 22, or around a third of them, ended up testing positive for COVID-19. At a minimum, that means Martha contact tracers identified 22 locals with coronavirus, including people with no symptoms, and told them to isolate before they could spread the disease. But that number doesn't reflect the impact of preventing spread to the people that the second group could have come in contact with, if not for the speedy tracing. Based on local data, Culbertson gave the transmission rate in Martha, that is, the average number of new infections that result from an infected person, also known as the R-naught of a virus, at 0.9. In other words, if 10 Marfans are confirmed to have coronavirus, they would likely spread it to an average of 9 people. Extrapolating from the data, those 22 infections could have infected around 20 more people if they hadn't isolated early. That's a total of around 42 cases that Martha's contact tracing team handled at critical early stages, counting both the 22 cases that were identified and an estimated 20 cases that were likely prevented altogether. With more testing in the region last week, Culbertson stressed that this transmission rate might not still be up to date. After months in the works, Martha now also has evidence that its contact tracing program is paying dividends. City leaders mulled the launch of a contact tracing program since the early days of the coronavirus crisis, as the Big Bend Sentinel previously reported, but the program officially launched in September. City leaders at the time argued that they could more quickly identify and trace local cases and lobbied state officials to set up a more collaborative relationship. Those efforts seemed prescient, especially now that those same state officials are struggling to manage outbreaks in El Paso and throughout the region. The program isn't without problems. In an interview on Monday, Culbertson said he was still waiting on an official approval to trace people in outlying neighborhoods like Sal Cipuedes, which are outside of the city jurisdiction. Culbertson also worries not enough Marfans know about the program and hopes city officials will keep running public service announcements. Of all the cases the team has worked, he estimated he's found at least half through data provided by regional health workers. But as the region sees a case spike, local health officials now warn they're not getting the same quality of data from the state. Regardless, the program is earning admirers in Presidio County and beyond. Judge Cinderella Guevara, who at first was skeptical that Martha was even allowed to set up local contact tracing, credits the program with stopping more infections in the area. "I believe it has been very effective," Judge Guevara said of the program in an interview on Monday. "There's been situations where I think if contact tracing wasn't happening, then there would be more infections." Teresa Todd, the city attorney for Martha, who helped arrange the agreement with state officials, felt the same. She called the efficacy of the program very encouraging and said it was helping locals who probably would not have received that help otherwise. "I know it's working," she said of the city's contact tracing efforts. "I know a lot of times We give information to DSHS, the Texas Department of State Health Services, before they give it to us. Other local governments in the region have already started reaching out in hopes of tapping into MARFA's expertise. Presidio has reached out about improving their local testing, Culbertson said. In addition to the city contact tracing team, MARFA city officials have also approved a rapid testing machine. Todd, who also serves as the county attorney for the Jeff Davis County, said she's also been in talks with county officials about setting up contact tracing there, either on their own or with some kind of collaboration. Like in MARFA, she says, many Jeff Davis County residents would likely be more comfortable talking to somebody from MARFA than El Paso when it comes to private medical questions. By the end of the year, Todd hopes to see an agreement between MARFA and Presidio County, allowing contact tracing in outlying neighborhoods like Sal Cipuedes. And while the program is currently funded by federal emergency funding, Todd hopes MARFA will keep the program going, whether or not Congress signs a 2021 stimulus bill. While MARFA's contact tracing program is currently funded by federal coronavirus money, Todd thinks it's working too well to abandon it if more emergency funds don't arrive by January. If we keep the program afloat for 6 months, hopefully we'll get reinforcements, she said. Ahead of Thanksgiving, officials offer advice as COVID hits an all-time high. By Stephen Paulson, Tri-County. By now, many residents know the basic precautions they can take to minimize the risk of coronavirus. Those basic tips, which Presidio County Judge Cinderella Guevara regularly reiterates in news releases, include wearing a mask, washing hands regularly, and keeping at least 6 feet of distance from other people. But researchers continue to learn more about coronavirus, and with family-oriented holidays like Thanksgiving and Christmas around the corner, officials in the region are promoting additional precautions they say could help keep residents from getting sick. Here's some of the advice that local residents may not be aware of, but that local officials and healthcare workers have been recently trying to emphasize. Small gatherings are a big source of spread. When Texas first adopted statewide precautions this year, those included limits on public places like bars and restaurants. But as the coronavirus crisis has continued, local officials and health workers say a growing number of cases are coming from small gatherings. Increasingly, local health workers say they're seeing cases that are tied to small family get-togethers rather than just public outings or events. That fits with findings from federal health officials, and it matters because many people who attend gatherings at the homes of friends and relatives may feel a false sense of security about seeing close acquaintances. After months of social and economic sacrifices, Melinda Richardson, the EMS director for Presidio, acknowledges that some locals might be unwilling to cut out small get-togethers as well. But if people do decide to have a small event at someone's home, they should continue to follow precautions, she said. Keep the gathering small, she says, and stay outside. Keep distancing and keep wearing masks as much as possible. With a number of promising vaccines on the way, she also echoed advice from other health officials. Missing a Thanksgiving party this year might be hard, but it's better than having a relative become sick or die. No symptoms doesn't mean someone is safe, and vice versa. Experts have known for months that people without symptoms can still spread coronavirus. But as coronavirus spreads through the Tri-County, officials say too many locals are forgetting this fact. Judge Cinderella Guevara has increasingly warned of criminal consequences for those who violate quarantine orders. Dawn Culbertson, a physician assistant at MARFA Clinic and director of MARFA's contact tracing program, said he's been trying to communicate that symptoms aren't a good measure of how contagious someone is. A person's individual symptoms are not a good benchmark for their ability to transmit the virus, he said. That also means people who have been placed into quarantine need to run the whole course and not assume that a negative test can get them out. You cannot test your way out of isolation or quarantine, Culbertson said later in an email. The two negative tests to return to work or school is not a thing. On the flip side, Culbertson stressed that some people who have COVID, that is, the long haulers, may continue to have symptoms weeks or months after they have stopped being contagious. In those cases, he said, People should trust that someone who's already been released from quarantine is no longer a danger to others. If someone has had inflammation in their lungs, they might be coughing in their cubicle for weeks and months afterward, he said. That doesn't mean they're positive and spewing the virus everywhere. Limit outings and trips. As coronavirus cases continue to climb in the Tri-County, some residents may not see a problem with taking a day trip to El Paso or Midland, Odessa. But local officials are warning against that thinking. While locals can certainly catch coronavirus locally, some places like El Paso are even riskier. And regardless, day trips can act like wind in a wildfire, spreading flames from one region to another and undermining attempts to control the spread. On a related note, officials in El Paso this month said that the big box stores were becoming a major source of spread in the border city. For now, Dr. John Paul J.P. Schwartz, the local health authority for Presidio County, is urging locals not to take trips there. Across the far west Texas region, coronavirus is just so prevalent right now, Dr. Schwartz said. I would really super advise people not to go into El Paso. Contact tracers aren't cops. If people with coronavirus violate quarantine orders, they could well face criminal consequences. But those consequences would be meted out by law enforcement, not by health workers. At a presentation last week, Marfa's contact tracing team emphasized this point. They said they wanted locals to feel comfortable talking to contact tracers, whose role is to find coronavirus cases and limit spread, not to punish people. State health workers have been overwhelmed by new cases, Culbertson said at the presentation, and Marfa's local contact tracing efforts are more important than ever. For that reason, he said, he didn't want locals associating his contact tracing work with any punitive measure. It could make us less popular, he warned, potentially limiting the number of people who would call in to Marfa's hotline. Go easy on the exercise. By now, most locals hopefully know that they can spread coronavirus even without symptoms, but they might not know that exercising without symptoms can still be risky, Culbertson said. Exerting oneself physically during COVID isn't a great idea, he said, noting that COVID-19 is an inflammatory disease. He recommended that people who have recovered should visit a doctor for a post-COVID condition report so they can check on their blood pressure and other health metrics before returning to a rigorous physical activity. On a related note, health officials are increasingly warning of the risks of organized contact sports like football. Players of those sports don't just come into close contact with players from other teams during the games. They are also in close quarters with teammates during games and the long bus rides to away games. In an interview last week, Dr. Schwartz said he didn't see anything coming out of the CDC on how you can safely play football. And while football season is over, basketball season, which typically involves indoor games, is starting next week. Marfa Superintendent Oscar Aguero said in an interview Wednesday that there were no immediate plans to cancel contact sports, noting that school officials were doing a great job of sanitizing and enforcing CDC guidelines, and that so far most Marfa ISD cases appear to be not school-related. We are doing all the things that the CDC recommends, and we don't see the spread happening within the school, Aguero said. That's where we're at right now. It could change. Ahead of local church's Thanksgiving meal, great needs are met with greater generosity. By Big Ben Sentinel. Marfa. The annual Thanksgiving community meal at St. Paul's Episcopal Church will take place on a new shape this year, as communal gatherings are being discouraged this holiday season in light of coronavirus cases growing across the United States, Texas, and the Big Bend region. Vicar Michael Wallen said this year his church will be collecting food donations and distributing them to families who want or need them. We've obviously changed because the virus has changed how we're doing things. At first, the church planned to set up a buffet where hungry townspeople could go through the line with their masks on, make plates of food, and take them home, rather than eating at the church. But as COVID-19 numbers have grown steadily over the past month, Wallen said the plans changed. Thanksgiving fixings will now be boxed up early and delivered this Sunday to give people time to do whatever preparations they need, Wallen said. The vicar has also seen a growing need for assistance among the community, not only for food, but for financial and mental support. People are coming to me individually or emailing me and asking for assistance, and not just with food, but with bills, he said. There's more requests for money from the discretionary fund, so the need is greater, Wallen said. And in the way the virus works, isolation impacts people's moods, their way of viewing the world. But the outpouring of generosity has been great too, Wallen said. His congregation has been doing continuous food collections at the church and then taking them to the local Marfa food pantry. The local Dairy Queen is donating 6 turkeys and keeping them in freezers for now, so the church doesn't run out of space to store food for the big holiday next week. If people want to donate food or make donations, that'd be great. If they want to help with their masks on to box up stuff, that will be done the Sunday before Thanksgiving. The church is currently collecting names of those who want a Thanksgiving box. Call 915-239-7409 or email St. Paul's Marfa, Texas at gmail.com. Wallen said, we want to keep our tradition of feeding people, but at the same time, be safe.
Hello, this is Cindy reading from the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, November 12th. Dominguez honored by state senator by Nathan Heuer. Jesse Dominguez received a Senate proclamation honor from Senator Pete Flores for nearly 20 years of service in Pecos County with numerous agencies and departments, including the Fort Stockton Fire Department, Pecos County Sheriff's Office, and Pecos County EMS. Dominguez received the recognition at the Pecos County Courthouse on October 29th. Flores read the proclamation during the ceremony, stating, Senate Proclamation 370, whereas the Senate of the State of Texas is pleased to recognize Jesse Dominguez for his many years of outstanding service to the people of Fort Stockton and Pecos County. Whereas Jesse Dominguez began his years of public service in August of 2001 as deputy sheriff in the Pecos County Sheriff's Office. In the December of that same year, he joined the Fort Stockton Fire Department as a firefighter, and whereas in 2014, he took on a second role in the sheriff's office as the county's emergency management coordinator. And under his leadership, the county has worked diligently to improve its response to unforeseen disaster and emergency. Whereas known for his ever-present willingness to serve the community, he also became chief of the Fort Stockton Fire Department in 2018. Over the course of his career, he has handled the unique challenges of law enforcement and firefighting duties with courage and exceptional dedication. Whereas an exemplary public servant, he is respected and admired by his colleagues and area citizens. It is truly fitting that he receives special recognition, his leadership and many contributions to his community. Now, therefore, be it proclaimed that the Senate of the State of Texas hereby commend Jesse Dominguez on nearly 2 decades of outstanding public service and send to him best wishes for future success in all his endeavors. To be it further proclaimed that a copy of this proclamation be prepared for him as an expression of esteem for the Texas Senate. County approved scanners purchase. Pecos County EMS crew to receive 2 new ambulances by Nathan Heuer. The Pecos County Commissioners decided to move forward with the purchase of 5 new GoSafe body temperature and facial recognition scanners during their regular meeting on Monday, November 9th. The 5 scanners purchased from Team First Technologies will be used at 4 different locations, include the county court, district court, county annex, and 2 in the county jail. What we'll do is we'll place it, the scanners, at the doors of the court, and they'll come in and put their face in front of the panel. That will give us a digital picture of that person's face. Plus, it'll give us a temperature, and the person at the door will recognize that person, whoever that person is on the agenda or scheduled to be in court, Pecos County Judge Joe Schuster said. The county jail will use 1 for inmates and 1 for visitors once they are allowed, as they are not currently. The cost of the five scanners combined is $9,975, and with the 5 4-foot floor stands, $1,420.25, as well as shipping, $447.50. The total cost comes out to be $11,842.75. Before the unanimous motion to purchase the scanners and stands on Monday, no location in Pecos County had fake facial recognition software. This is new because of COVID. A person needs to be checked every time they leave and come back. The facial recognition verifies they are that same person, Schuster said. The commissioners unanimously approved another purchase at the meeting that'll benefit first responders, a Fraser ambulance that features a UVC air and surface disinfection lamp and ceiling raceway with control unit in electrical compartment was approved by the Pecos County EMS. The UV light component disinfects germs and would aid in the effort to prevent the spread of COVID-19. The cost of the ambulance after a 5% order discount is $181,935. The vehicle will likely be received in 2021, but the delivery date is unknown due to back orders from the vendor. Pecos County EMS has yet to receive their new ambulance from this past year, which was scheduled to be delivered in October. Pecos County EMS was hopeful to receive the vehicle by February at the latest. COVID-19 active case numbers plummet. FSISD staff members only active case in school system by Nathan Hewer. Recoveries from COVID-19 far surpassed new active cases from November 3rd to November 10th, and as a result, active case numbers dropped from 64 to 34 in a week's time in Pecos County. A total of 47 residents from Pecos County recovered over the past week, while only 17 people tested positive in that span. No new fatalities occurred over the past 7 days, although Pecos County COVID-19-related deaths moved from 18 to 19 due to a death being referred from Brewster County to Pecos County from a fatality that occurred on October 21st. The death was an 81-year-old female who was hospitalized at PCMH on October 14th. Also this past week, a COVID-19 update from the Fort Stockton Independent School District was given by Assistant Superintendent Gilray Madrid on Thursday, November 5th, at the Fort Stockton Pioneers Weekly Update via Facebook Live with County Judge Joe Schuster and Mayor Chris Alexander. Madrid stated that since the start of the school year, 15 students and 13 staff members have tested positive for COVID-19. As of November 5th, only one staff member had not recovered, and no students were active cases. Of the 15 students who have tested positive for the coronavirus, 11 have been high school students. The FSISD does temperature scans of students and staff every day to minimize the spread of the virus. Thus far, no students have had temperatures on any campus. The assistant superintendent also said the school is following protocols set in place by the Texas Education Agency. What we do is we notify the individuals of that campus, the parents and staff, and let them know there is a positive test. Sometimes it can be a few days later when they're cleared to come to school, Madrid said. The rules have changed throughout this whole process. If people have no symptoms after 10 days, they can come to school and work. If they don't, then they have 4 more days they wait. We also encourage if anyone is being tested in the household to keep the students at home. We'll work with you till everyone gets cleared, then come back to work or school. Madrid added that if any student travels internationally and returns, they need to quarantine 14 days before returning to school as recommended by the CDC. COVID-19 statistics in Pecos County since the start of the pandemic is as follows. There have been 2,741 people tested for COVID-19, with 2,120 coming back as negative tests. There is 79 tests currently pending and 444 positive tests since the start of the pandemic. A total of 391 people have recovered from the virus and a total of 19 deaths, putting the death rate at 4.2% for positive tests in Pecos County. Former FSHS graduate killed in car accident by Nathan Hewer. A 2019 Fort Stockton High School graduate, Justin Galindo, passed away early Saturday morning on November 7th in a head-on collision in Odessa, Texas. The 20-year-old Galindo was heading north on South Loop 338 in Odessa when he crossed the center line in his 2014 Dodge Charger. Galindo's vehicle collided with a 2015 Toyota Tundra driven by 54-year-old William R. Fernstate of Andrews, Texas, at 3:48 a.m., according to the Texas Department of Safety. Fernstate had incapacitating injuries and was transported to Medical Center Hospital in Odessa. Following the preliminary investigation, it was determined that the 54-year-old was wearing a seatbelt. It was unknown if Galindo was wearing one. Galindo was pronounced dead on the scene by the Ector County Medical Examiner. Road conditions were dry, and weather conditions were clear, according to the report. Do Something, your guide to local places to go and things to do. Friday, December 4th. The Season of Hope 2020 Christmas Parade will be held on Friday, December 4th at 6:30 p.m. Parade lineup begins at 5:30 p.m. on Rio Street. Contact the Chamber after 10 a.m. Friday, December 4th to get your assigned lineup spot. Assignments are subject to change. Check in at lineup to confirm. Please visit www.fortstockton.org/events to see COVID-19 guidelines and restrictions for the event. Obituaries from the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, November 12. After a long battle with Parkinson's, Weldon Bogus went to be with his Lord on November 4th in Bryan, Texas. He was born in Rochester, Texas, to F.G. and Lily Bell Bogus. He is preceded in death by his parents, Sister Maxine Reed, and oldest son, Weldon G. Bogus, Jr. Weldon will be sorely missed by his wife, Shirley Bogus of Bryan, Texas, son and daughter-in-law, Tom and Charlene Bogus of Bryan, daughter-in-law, Becky Beckman of Oak Point, Texas. Grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and nieces and nephews. Memorials can be made to the following: Hospice Brazos Valley, 502 West 26th Street, Bryan, Texas, 77803. Granite Mountain Baptist Church, 500 Farm to Market, 1980, Marble Falls, Texas, 78654. First Baptist Church, Bryan, fbcbryan.org. Parkinson's Foundation, 1359 Broadway, Suite 1509, New York, New York, 10018. Weldon's care entrusted to Putnam Funeral Home and Crematory in Kingsland. Carlos Galvan passed away on November 8th at the age of 70. He was born October 26, 1950, in Cameron County, Texas, to Melesio Galvan and Zenaida Garcia, who preceded him in death. Survivors include his wife Maria Galvan, brothers Guadalupe and Daniel, sisters Gloria Santos and Virginia. Preceding him in death were his brothers Erasmo and Clemente, his sister Pilar. Visitation was Tuesday, November 10th at 10 a.m. at Heritage Funeral. Rosary and service followed at Heritage Funeral Home. Eli Carrasco Ponce of Fort Stockton passed away peacefully at home with his family by his side on October 17th. He was 39 years old. He was born December 4th, 1980, to Nettie and Philemon Ponce, Jr. He is survived by his own Ponce bunch of handsome young men and precious girls, Isaiah, David, Jeremiah, Genesis, Kaylee, Jade, Ponce, and granddaughter, as well as his father, Philemon, Ponce Jr., his mother and stepfather, Nettie and Raj Chopra, sisters Monique, Ponce, and Pooja Boinpally, and brother Vishal Chopra, grandmothers Beatrice Ponce and Maria Turin, and grandfather Jesus Carrasco. He was preceded in death by his grandfather, Reverend Philemon Ponce Sr. Eli's most selfless act was his decision to donate his whole body to the University of Texas Health System for research to help other people who will also fight a rare condition known as Wilson's disease. Aurelia Leia Dominguez entered rest on November 2nd. She was born on July 20, 1930, in Fort Stockton, to Felix Porras and Cruz Franco. Survivors include Alfredo, Freddy Dominguez, and wife Juanita of Fort Stockton, daughters Annabella Gutierrez and husband Abel of Fort Stockton, Alma Acosta and husband Ruben of McCamey, Adelina Baeza and husband Randy of Midland, and Arcelia Fuller and husband Nathan of Kirtland, New Mexico, sisters Aurora Duran and Estolia Holguin, 14 grandchildren, 20 great-grandchildren, and 3 great-great-grandchildren. Preceding her in death were her parents and husband, J.R. Cudi Dominguez, son Aiden Donnie Dominguez, brothers Manuel Salmon and Abelino Salmon, sisters Elfida Franco and Luisa Porras. Visitation was held Thursday at Heritage Funeral Home in Fort Stockton. Services will be Friday, November 6th at 10 a.m. at Our Lady of Guadalupe, downtown campus, Fort Stockton. Due to coronavirus, the occupancy is limited at all locations. Justin Galindo passed away on November 7th at the age of 20 years old. He was born May 8, 2000, in Guymon, Oklahoma. Survivors include his mom and stepdad, Eloy Rodriguez and Norma Galindo, sisters Katie, Amy Amarini, and Litzy Rodriguez, aunts and uncles and cousins. Preceded him in death, his grandparents Gregorio Galindo and Hortensia Galindo. Visitation was Thursday, November 12th at the and Rosary at Heritage Funeral Home. Services were at Our Lady of Guadalupe. Enrique Henry Quiroz Vasquez passed away on November 3rd in Fort Stockton. Enrique was born in Nacimiento, Coahuila, Mexico, to Baltazar Vasquez and Valentina Quiroz Vasquez on January 9, 1932. He is preceded in death by his parents, sisters Paula Vasquez Watson, Evelia Vasquez Gonzalez, Otilia Vasquez White, brother Juan Vasquez, and grandson Javier Javi Alejandro Rodriguez. He is survived by his beloved wife Josefa Arambidez Vasquez, children Rosalie Vasquez from Lovington, New Mexico, Mike Vasquez from Fort Stockton, Janie V. Rodriguez and husband Rodolfo Rodriguez, Jr., Janet V. Dunn and husband Mark Dunn from Odessa, Joanne V. Velasquez and husband Bobby Velasquez, Josephine Josie V. Barnes and husband Reginald Barnes of Little Rock, Arkansas, Bill Vasquez of Fort Stockton, sister Minerva Jackson from Kerrville, brother Balatazar Vasquez from Kerrville, brother Marcelo Vasquez and wife Debbie from Las Vegas, Natividad Vasquez and wife Winora from Colleen, brother Antonio Vasquez and wife Elizabeth from Kerrville. Enrique had 11 grandkids and 19 grandkids and a host of nieces and nephews.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahan's News for Thursday, November 12th. ACLU monitoring MWP-ISD grooming code fight. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. It has been a little over 2 months since the Texas arm of the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, sent a letter to Monahans Wicked Paiute ISD, as well as over 400 other school districts across the state, asking them to revise dress code policies that it says are unconstitutional and discriminatory. For two local families, the answer to whether or not revisions will be made is turning into a long and lengthy process. According to ACLU attorney Brian Klosterboer, the ACLU is monitoring the dress code situation at MWP ISD and supports the families going through the grievance process. Quote, "We have been monitoring what is going on regarding the dress grooming codes at Monahan schools and are concerned. We do remain hopeful that the school board will give the families a fair shot and take an opportunity to look into these families and to proactively take steps to respond to them and take the steps necessary to fix the discriminatory dress grooming code," Klosterboer said. In July, the Barbers Hill ISD Board of Trustees unanimously voted to deny grievances filed by the Texas ACLU and the Juvenile and Children's Advocacy Project of Texas. The grievances challenged the district's hair policy as unconstitutional and discriminatory. Quote, "This issue still has not been resolved, even though it ended up in federal court, all the while racking up a tremendous amount of legal fees, all at the taxpayers' expense. This is really disappointing and harmful to the students there who are facing this kind of discrimination," he added. The ACLU holds policies that discriminate between boys and girls regarding grooming are unconstitutional. Klosterboer said, "The way for MWP ISD to avoid the possibility of litigation or more controversy down the road is to conform and make policy changes to the grooming code." Quote, "I hope the MWP ISD school board will take the opportunity they have to do the right thing in treating students equally and to not discriminate against students who wear their hair in different ways by changing their policies to conform to federal law," he said. Klosterboer added, "The ACLU may send out further correspondence to the school district showing their support for the families going through the grievance process." Local mothers, Rebecca Kynes and Desiree Valle, both of whom had a child singled out for violating the hair code, have filed grievances against the school and are waiting for an opportunity to address the school board to ask for a revision or change to the dress grooming code. Kynes' child, a Tatum Elementary first grader, was to be suspended from in-person instruction after she refused to get his shoulder-length haircut. And Valya's son, a Sudeth Elementary fourth grader, was also threatened with school suspension over his hair, which was long on top and shaved on both sides, even though both families provided proof of their child's Native American lineage. Kynes filed a Level 3 grievance this past Friday, which entitles her to a chance to speak to the school board in an open meeting format. Quote, "I received a letter on Tuesday stating the filed complaint will be on the agenda for presentation to the board," she said. The next school board meeting is on Monday, November 16th. Kynes had her Level 2 meeting with Superintendent of School Chad Smith on October 20th. Quote, "In that meeting, Mr. Smith told me he had called the Bureau of Indian Affairs to verify our Native American lineage, and as far as that goes, for my child, I was good," Kynes said. However, when Kynes received the written response from Smith in the mail on October 29th, it did not state anything about a waiver for the grooming code. Quote, "The letter basically said he can't make any changes to the dress grooming code and he must adhere to and comply with the school board dress code policy, she said. Kynes added she emailed Smith for clarification on the waiver, but as of press time, has not received a response from Smith. Faye, who filed grievances against the school and MWP ISD Chief of Police Orlando Orona, had a meeting with Sudeth Elementary Principal Kim Thomas on October 21st. Quote, "During my meeting with Mrs. Thomas, my son was given a chance to read a letter he wrote about all this, and then I spoke and told her my reasonings for wanting to be able to keep my son's hair like it is and not cut it," Faye said. Thomas relayed that she was there to listen and not speak, and that she would mail Valle a response within 10 business days. Quote, "My response from Mrs. Thomas was just as I expected, and simply reiterated what I and my son said during the meeting, and finished off by stating she was not able to make any changes to the policy, and had to adhere to and comply with adopted school board dress code policy," she said. Faye has since filed a Level 2 grievance last Friday, which would allow her a meeting with Smith. The grievance meeting about Chief Orona, after he told her to drop the hair issue or she would be banned from coming on the Sudeth Elementary campus, was handled by a representative for Orona, Jeff Jones, on October 30th. Quote, "I wasn't aware of the meeting with Mr. Jones until the day before the meeting," Faye said. The letter was sent from the school on October 26 by certified mail and had to be picked up from the post office. Quote, "I was working, so it was harder for me to get up to the post office and get it. I thought I would be meeting with Mr. Smith for my grievance against Chief Orona, because on the paperwork, it states Smith is Orona's supervisor, but it was Mr. Jones instead," Valle said. At the meeting, Jones told Valle the floor was hers and to give him all the background information she had and what she believed he needed to be able to give a response. Quote, "I was there to talk about Chief Orona, but halfway through the meeting, Mr. Jones begins explaining to me the difference between concerns and policy, and speaking to me as if I was a teenager who did not understand the difference," Faye explained. As of press time, Faye has not received a response from Jones regarding her meeting. Faye said she was denied the paperwork she needed to file the Level 2 grievance against the school. Quote, "I had to go back to the administration building and argue with them because they didn't understand I had two grievances, and I assume they called Mrs. Thomas to make sure I got my letter from her," Valle said. Mr. Jones also told Valle he would call her to let her know when she could pick up the paperwork needed to file the Level 2 with Chief Orona. Quote, "He did not believe that I was owed a Level 2 grievance meeting. I still haven't heard from Jones on when I can pick up that paperwork," Faye added. The news will continue to follow the story as new updates become available. Deutsch sentenced to 3 years in TDCJ for theft and burglary. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Cody Howard Deutsch, age 35, of 1303 South Main Street, was sentenced last week by Judge Mike Swanson to 3 years in a Texas Department of Criminal Justice facility after having his probation revoked on two charges of burglary and pleading guilty to an additional charge of theft. Deutsch's charges date back to March 2016, when he was arrested for burglary of a building, a state jail felony, after he did knowingly and intentionally enter a building without the consent of the owner, Nelda Patterson Helmers, taking such items as soft drinks, cookies, and sausages, which was owned by Patterson. In May 2016, Deutsch was booked again for burglary of a building when he did knowingly and intentionally enter a building owned by Richard Nolan Barmore without his consent. Deutsch was sentenced to probation for both of the above-mentioned offenses. The offenses can be punishable by imprisonment in a state jail facility for any term of not more than 2 years or less than 180 days, and a fine not to exceed $10,000. In August, Deutsch was arrested for a third time for theft of property over $30,000 but less than $150,000, a third-degree felony. When, according to the indictment, Deutsch took spools of wire from Chevron USA in the value of $30,000 or more, but less than $150,000 on August 17th. Deutsch's probation was revoked after he violated the terms of being arrested on the third charge. Deutsch was given 21 months each on both of the community supervision revocations and a 3-year sentence on the theft charge, all which he will serve concurrently. Deutsch was represented by Trent Graham on all 3 cases and was ordered to pay a fine of $909. Attorneys for the state on all 3 cases were 143rd District Attorney Randall W. Reynolds and Assistant District Attorney Camilla Cutberth. COVID data lagging from DSHS. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. Data from the Texas Department of State Health Services, DSHS, seems to have slowed. As of Tuesday afternoon, there had been no updates since last Friday, November 6th, according to Ward County Judge Greg Holley. But those latest numbers reflect 2 confirmed cases of COVID-19 and 6 probable. Totals to date were 180 cases, 175 recovered, and 3 deaths. Probable cases were 96 cases, with 89 recovered and 1 death. Information from Ward Memorial Hospital on Wednesday morning was 1,524 tests administered, with 38 pending. Holley said, quote, "Our numbers of active cases are certainly higher than this report reflects. While we've had some folks pass their recovery dates and thus reduce that number, we have not received updates on new cases since late last week. I know we have new cases that haven't hit the report. In addition, our hospital folks advised me last night, Monday, that we have several COVID patients in the hospital, in addition to other patients, and have had some challenges with staffing. All infected patients are being cared for in isolated rooms, and capacity is currently being expanded so that we're prepared in the event we have more demand." End quote. Statewide, as of November 9th, 8.9 million tests have been administered, with 974,230 confirmed cases, with 18,863 deaths. Currently, there is an estimated 132,000 active cases. A total of 253 of 254 counties in Texas are reporting active cases. Loving County is the only county in Texas that has no active cases. Second drive-through health fair on Monday. To help the community stay safe and healthy this holiday season, Ward Memorial Hospital is hosting a second drive-through mini health fair on November 16th from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. The event will feature flu shot and pneumonia shots, COVID-19 testing for adults over the age of 12, and free laboratory vouchers for common health screenings such as cholesterol, blood glucose, and prostate-specific antigen, PSA. A general health profile, CBC, CMP, lipid, thyroid, A1C, lab voucher will be offered for $50. Quote, "Our first drive-through mini health fair in early October proved very successful in helping people in our community take charge of their health, which is why we decided to host a second one," said Leticia C. Rodriguez. Quote, "This is a convenient opportunity to take advantage of important health care services and save money." End quote. This year's flu shot will be offered at the drive-through mini health fair. With the flu season in full swing during a major pandemic, health officials are urging everyone in the community to get the flu shot this year. Since the flu and COVID-19 often has similar symptoms, it can be difficult to determine which illness you have without testing. Health officials have warned that an increase in patients with the flu could cause testing delays for COVID-19 and could put further stress on hospital systems across the state. Health experts have warned that it may be possible to become sick with both viruses simultaneously, underscoring the importance of getting vaccinated. Those who visit the drive-through health fair can also take advantage of free and low-cost vouchers for cholesterol, glucose, and PSA and thyroid testing. Through a simple blood test, cholesterol test determine your cholesterol level so you can take steps to control your risk of heart disease. High levels of cholesterol can raise the risk for serious cardiovascular disease. Fortunately, consulting with your healthcare provider and making certain lifestyle changes can help you manage your cholesterol. Glucose testing can determine whether you have diabetes or are at risk of developing the disease. Those with what is known as pre-diabetes are considered at high risk of developing diabetes. However, making certain diet and lifestyle changes can help you improve your health and lower your risk of developing diabetes. Testing the level of a prostate-specific antigen, PSA, in the blood is a common way to screen for prostate cancer. Those with elevated PSA levels are at an increased risk of developing prostate cancer. COVID-19 testing will also be available for those over 18. Those who experience symptoms of COVID-19 and those who test positive are always asked to call first before arriving at the hospital or clinic in order to help prevent the spread of the dangerous disease. According to Rodriguez, taking the risk of COVID-19 seriously and taking steps to protect your health will be especially important this holiday season. Quote, "We are expecting the COVID-19 will remain a serious threat during the holidays and into the winter," she said. "That is why protecting your health is so important. This mini health fair can help you ensure that you are in good health." End quote. The drive-through health fair will take place on November 16th from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. at Ward Memorial Hospital at 406 South Gary Avenue in Monahans. More information about local health care services is available at www.wardmemorial.com. Here are some obituaries that appeared in the Monahans News on November 12th. Marshal Stephen Clark, age 73, passed away on Thursday, November 5th. He was born on February 12, 1947, in Monahans to his parents, R.E. and Ima Clark, at Turney Hospital. Marshall grew up in Monahans. On November 27, 1986, he married Deborah K. Clark. He is preceded in death by his parents, R.E. and Ima Clark, along with brother Rasco Clark. Marshall is survived by his wife Deborah Clark of Ruidoso, New Mexico, brother Jerry Clark of Ozona, sister Ann Lewis of Ozona, daughters Stephanie Clark of Ruidoso, New Mexico, Devin Grisby and husband Jay of Aubrey, Candace Hall of Ruidoso, New Mexico, Bridget Hall and fiancé Ivan Stewart of Alamogordo, New Mexico, four grandchildren, four great-grandchildren, along with many nieces, nephews, and cousins. Funeral services were held on Thursday, November 12th, at the Shiloh Baptist Church. Flowers or donations may be sent to Harkey Funeral Home. Services in care of Harkey Funeral Home. Visit harkeyfunerals.com for online condolences. William Edward Clayton, Jr. went home to be with our Lord and Savior on October 31st. Eddie was born on March 4th, 1945, to Polly Sue and William Edward Clayton in Lovington, New Mexico. He moved to Monahans shortly before enlisting in the United States Army. He served his country proudly in a logistics role during the Vietnam War. After being honorably discharged from the Army, Eddie made his home in Monahans. He met his future wife, Connie, and they began building a life together. He went to work for Alsup's. He would eventually retire from Alsup's as the area supervisor over several stores from Monahans to Hobbs, New Mexico. Eddie is preceded in death by his parents, Sue and Bill Clayton, two brothers, James Clayton, Alan Clayton, and his ex-wife, Connie Clayton. He is survived by his sisters, Donna Gardner, Diana Little, Deborah Dunn, children, Bert Thornton, Stoney Clayton, Chantel Woods, Mary Nell Clayton, six grandchildren, as well as nieces and nephews. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to a Veterans Foundation of your choice. Funeral services were held Monday, November 9th, at Monahans First Assembly of God Church, with Pastor Richard Knight officiating. Burial followed at Dawson County Cemetery in La Mesa. Funeral arrangements are under the direction of Harkey Funeral Home. Visit our website, harkeyfunerals.com, to sign the guest book or leave a personal note for the family.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.